frequencies are open. Welcome to the Infinite Potato Alliance.
This episode of that Star Trek podcast contains spoilers for the latest episode of Star Trek Discovery and some harsh language. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to That Star Trek Podcast. This is your place for detailed analysis and speculation of all things Trek. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of That Star Trek Podcast, your one-stop pod for reviews, examination, and speculation of all things Trek. My name is Scott, and I am your host, and I am joined by my usual suspects, a fine panel of Star Trek discussioners. New word. Let's introduce everybody. We have John joining us. How's things going?
Things going good.
Perfectly executed. Joined as well by my brother Tom. How are things?
I don't need to know how the cake is boiled.
Is that a thing on Killer?
Apparently.
Don't knock till you try it.
There you go. There it is. Joining us, as usual, we have Neek. Glad to have you. How are you?
I like misremembering quotes and long walks on the beach.
And finally, hauling himself from his sick bed. He is not feeling well, but we are well off to have him. I didn't plan that beforehand. Rick, how do you feel?
The aperture is too small.
TMI.
Ew.
I didn't have one planned. I wasn't planning on doing one, and that just... I'm sorry.
But so apt. I assume.
Meanwhile,
we are here to discuss another episode of Star Trek Discovery, folks. Season 5, Episode 5, titled Mirrors. Written by Joanna Lee and Carlos Cisco, directed by Jen McGowan. I found this to be not a horrible... I can't say this episode is fantastic, but I thought it was pretty good. I found myself enjoying it most of the time, and I want to hear what everyone else thought. So going in reverse order, Rick, give us your broad strokes on how you felt about this episode.
I liked it. I like that we got to see more of Maul and Locke and more of their backstory. I still like them, and I still stand by my that they are not evil. They are just petty crooks caught up in way too much, which I have a discussion for later, but not right now. I'm the Breen. I think I like them better when we didn't know what they looked like under the helmet. But... you know, it's that I want to know, but now that I know, it's just another green alien race, and that's not so interesting anymore. But yeah, but I've tried to work up some outrage over the ISS Enterprise, but it's, you know, they had the sets, they saved some money, put a little more into the lore. Yeah, it's fine.
As far as the Breen goes, I think there's in this season still potential and more to explore. We found out a little, but not a whole lot of information went along with what was revealed about the Breen. So I think there's room for us to get potentially up to a good deal more that might make the two-face thing more interesting. I want to see if they do more with that. I hope they do. Neek, our resident recapper, what are your thoughts on this episode?
Typically, when I recap the episodes, so I'm watching it for the second time with a lot of scrutiny, I like the episodes more because I sort of get a greater understanding of what they were going for. Whether or not they executed that well is another question. But for this episode, I sort of had the opposite journey where I thought it was a good time. I really enjoyed it. And then upon reflection, like once I started studying the episode, I was like, oh, there are actually a lot of problems with this episode. But, you know, my enjoyment was not diminished. I thought it was fun. And I've been saying that about every episode this season. I like this season of Disco. I find it fun, which is a breath of fresh air for Disco because it's usually so dour. So I enjoyed it.
All right. Next up, Tom, what are your thoughts on Mirrors?
Yeah, not too bad. You know, overall enjoyed the episode. The backstory with Lal and Maul and Locke. Thank you. The backstory with those two kind of shifted my interpretation of their interactions. It really flipped it over from what I had been picturing from the previous episodes. So that was nice understanding there. I didn't have any big problem with the ISS Enterprise like some people have had. They could have done it as any other ship, but, you know, like they did in that Strange New World episode with the Gorn. But no, it was fine. I think they had some good moments in there. Rick, you said you prefer the Breen when you didn't know what they looked like. Just think about the 800 years of changes and I mean, look how some of the other races have changed their appearance, like Ferengi. And so they don't look anything like this in the classic DS9 Breen that you had. So
well,
you've always got that.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to explain what I mean by this.
Exactly what you mean.
I had hoped that the Breen were something really exotic and that they could not live outside of their suits or something, you know, kind of like Vorlons or something. And then they're just another humanoid race with squishy green faces.
Well,
I'm not saying
that
this is a me thing. This is totally a me thing. I was kind of hoping that this was as close as Star Trek would get to a non-humanoid race and not do crappy CGI for like a, you know, species 8472 or something and just leave it with we never see them. I would have been fine with that.
Mm. John, I wanted to stop myself from starting a tangent on Breen aesthetics and their climate. We're going to move on. John, what did you think of this episode?
excuse me. I liked the episode fine. Pretty much where everyone else is. It was enjoyable enough. I didn't know what it was going to be about. I saw the episode. Was it Mirror, Mirror? Is it Mirror, Mirror?
Just Mirrors.
Mirrors.
Are you talking about this one or?
This one.
Okay, yeah. This one is Mirrors.
Yeah, and I was like, oh man, please. I don't want to see, like, I don't know, I guess it'd be upbeat book. Like, that was my worry. That was my fear. But it just happened to be in the Mirror Universe, and it just happened to, you know, just because it was on the ship. That's fine. Yeah, as far as like the overall plot of like following the clues to each piece, I felt like this one wasn't as cool as the previous ones had been. They just left it there. Like, you know, it was hard to get to, but they left it there. It wasn't like you had to, I don't know. But even that, it wasn't like that was a problem. But I like, surprise, surprise, I like the solving of puzzle parts. And they didn't really have to do that this time. I don't have an issue with the Breen. I don't know much of the history of the Breen, and I think nobody does. And I think the fact that they cover their faces and disguise themselves, but in reality they don't look super duper different from everybody else is kind of the point. Like they this is a well cultivated air of mystery that they work hard to establish and maintain. Yeah, it was good to see the Maul and Locke backstory behind the music, behind the mayhem. And it was not far off from what I was thinking that it was. They were clearly on the run, and they loved each other, and they had to make a run for it. It was fine. B minus episode. It's fine.
All right, I can get on board with that. Consulting the notes, we jump into the episode.
You didn't tell us how you liked it.
It was fine. So jumping into the notes, I like the episode. It seemed relatively clear to me that not necessarily just a bit of convenience. Oh, hey, we're going to do this episode and we'll set it on the ISS Enterprise because we have the set lying around. I'm sure that was like woven into the plan from the beginning rather than a last minute decision. Yet I still like that they chose to do that. It pulls rather like this whole season pulls the progenitor element from the chase. This episode is pulling an element from Mirror Mirror, and the larger mirror universe is adding more, I guess, backstory to, you know, things we've seen before. We've seen that Enterprise, and we only saw it in the one episode of TOS. What happened to it after that? Well, now we know, and I find that to be interesting. Did not find the Mal and Locke backstory as interesting as that. Once it was revealed to us in that first flashback scene that the one Breen that is talking with her one-on-one is Locke, I knew the rest of the flashback story from that moment. There are no surprises, which is fine. Just unsurprising. And Sean had mentioned in our group chat earlier today before we started recording that he is getting a little tired of the missed him by that much at the end of the episode where they can't quite catch Mal and Locke and they're still going after him. And I agree with him. I was anticipating that the chasing those two might come to an end in this episode, but apparently not. They still have to go after them and go after the clues. Sean is hoping that changes by next episode, and I hope so too. It's not going to ruin the show if it doesn't, but I hope we can change that dynamic, that aspect of the season as we move the story forward. Speaking of moving forward, this episode picks up nicely on the heels of the previous episode where Discovery still doesn't have the clue that they were looking for last episode. They were kind enough to do all of the techno work between episodes. So we open up with Stamets and Tilly explaining, hey, this is where they went to get the next clue. And we see an odd pulsating wormhole into interdimensional space. So immediately Michael decides that she has to go. And my immediate thought was, isn't this the third clue in a row that Michael has decided she's going to go and get it when Captain shouldn't be leading away missions? And it's I was really glad that Rainer actually tried to, you know, be Riker for a second and say, your place is here on the ship. I should be leading the mission. So anyone else have any thoughts on Rick? Clearly you do. So I want to hear from you first. Anyone's thoughts on Rainer trying to safeguard the captain by taking that away mission?
My first reaction was like yours, you know, captain stays on the boat, but we have to keep reminding ourselves that while Burnham has been in the 32nd century for a couple of years now, she still comes from the pre-Kirk era of cowboy diplomacy and, you know, captain gets out there and gets dirty with everyone else. It wasn't until TNG era that the captain, you know, you don't take your three most senior officers on every away mission became a thing. But I like that Rainer called her out on it, too. What was that, Tom?
Just three out of the four most senior officers.
Yeah.
Right. That's a fair point. I had not taken into account that she's coming at this from perhaps a different set of standard regulations. So that's fair. An aspect that I didn't think of, but it was pointed out to me earlier today, that Michael immediately turns it around and tries to make Rainer's suggestion about him, about, you know, why is it that you want to go on this mission? Why don't you want to stay on the ship? And that seemed a little odd.
Seemed a lot odd.
Yeah,
there was no evidence that it was about him at all. I didn't love that.
It seemed almost cruel on her part. Like she was trying to emotionally. It was almost like she was trying to gaslight him, actually, because he comes in with a completely reasonable thing of what you just said, Scott, that it's like, well, actually, I'm the first officer. I'm the one who should be doing these missions. And like, and she's like, oh, you're making this personal. It's actually, no, Michael, no, Michael, you're the one making it personal. And it's all well and good if she wants, because this is a dangerous mission. So she wants to take it on herself and not endanger other people because, you know, going into these, the situations with the clues, each time they've had to find one of these clues, it has been mortally dangerous. So if she's unwilling to put someone else's life on the line, that's fine. But then just say that instead of saying, Rainer, you're making this all about you. You're being super weird about this. Huh? Is it because you're afraid of this, that, or the other? It's like, wow, Michael. Like, to me, that was beyond the pale. That was like I said, it was like gaslighting.
Yeah, she was kind of coming out of nowhere.
Like, why did she even want him to be her XO if she's just going to treat him like shit?
She seemed to be acting as though she thinks that he is uncomfortable with the idea of leading a crew, when it wasn't his idea to not be a captain anymore in the first place.
And being he's done it longer than she has, frankly.
Yeah.
Being a captain was what he was all about. And now she's treating him as though he's scared to lead. And that didn't make sense to me. Go ahead, John.
She also could have just made the argument, well, Book has sort of a personal connection with one of them, and you know, Book and I have a shorthand, and it's also going to be super dangerous. Like, she could have made other arguments that make sense, as opposed to trying to make it seem like he was deficient in some way.
Exactly. Yeah. There's so many things she could have said to justify what she wants to do, but instead she made it about him. And that was, like I said, I feel it was cruel on her part.
The season has so far made it feel like Rainer, from the moment that she decided, I want him to be first officer, Rainer has become like a project for Michael. I want to turn you into a kind and fluffy captain who is comfortable caring about the officers that work under you. When it's not a requirement. Now, I'm not saying that it's better to be a captain who is not invested in your crew. Just show up and give them the orders and you know, expect them to do what they're told. But for some reason, he is her B plot. The A plot this season is finding the progenitor's technology. The B plot is rehabilitating and fixing Rainer. And I don't know why that is.
just another card in the file for the future. Is Michael Burnham a good captain? Show.
That's going to be our sequel podcast when this show is over.
I think I just feel like the writers are doing her a disservice, frankly.
Agreed.
There's no reason for her to take this tack. I wouldn't go necessarily as far as you, Scott. I don't think she's trying to like fix him per se, but you know, I know Discovery. I know this crew. This is what will be most effective with this crew. It's fine because he's on that ship. Like that's fine. But as you said, Neek, if part of the reason she chose him was to push against her and to, you know, offer this other perspective and to yin her yang, as it were, then be more accepting when he does.
I'm finding that with a lot of shows lately, I'm asking the question, do the writers know what they're doing? And what I mean by that is, so it's like you said, John, the writers are doing her a disservice, but is it deliberate on their part? Are like they trying to set up a situation where she's making the wrong choice or she's being condescending or she's doing the wrong thing so that later on it can pay off in some way? Or no. Do the writers not even realize that they've painted her in a bad light in the situation? Do the writers think that Michael was in the right in that situation?
I think it's the latter. I think that...
Then what the hell is wrong with these writers?
Yeah.
Even mean like just on Disco. It's like, because I see this kind of thing happening on a lot of shows lately where I'm like, who is in these writers' rooms? And like, what are they trying to say? And like, yeah, like, are they aware of the messages they're sending? Are they trying to send these messages? If they are trying to send these messages, why? Like, what is going on here?
It's almost like they default. The postulate is Michael is right. Like, you know, whichever position Michael has is the correct position. And, you know, then the show kind of, everything else filters that way. And that's not great. That's not great. Like, mm-hmm. I am fine with her being right. I'm fine with her being right most of the time. I don't even necessarily, like, it would be great if other people were right as well. But even when it's other people being right, and I don't want to sound like one of these people, like, oh, the Mary Sue, blah, blah, because I think that's all bullshit. But, like, narratively, there is an argument that, like, even when someone else's great idea saves the day, it's almost depicted often, well, Michael was the one who coaxed this idea out of them, or it was Michael's brilliance to accept this idea. Like, just... And that's what I mean when I say the writers are doing her a disservice. Like, she can be smart and capable without sucking up all the oxygen in the room. And it feels like that's the way the show is being presented.
That is, I think, supported by the fact that we're five episodes into the season, and it seems like the supporting characters are just falling away. Last week we saw Owosukun and Detmer a little bit, and I think that was like the second time we've really seen them this season. And this episode they get mentioned again, but not seen. Saru, we didn't see him at all this episode, and I'm having a hard time remembering. Did we see Saru last episode at all?
In stock footage. He wasn't actually in the show.
Stamets, he's there. He seems to be not around as much as we normally see him. This episode is putting it not by much, and I think we're seeing
more of Stamets than we usually do.
It's possible that I am seeing or not seeing Stamets through a filter of it feels like the supporting characters are not getting as much of a spotlight as they normally do. But I, that's just how it feels to me overall. There's nothing wrong with the captain of the ship being the main character of the show and getting most of the spotlight, but they seem to really be zooming in on Michael and Rainer at the expense of some of the other characters that we've been following for four seasons. And knowing this is the final season, I would like to see more of the characters that we've been seeing. Maybe it's just me.
No, I don't disagree, but I also they also didn't know it was the final season when they were filming most of this.
Touche.
One thing that just occurred to me, and I'm maybe giving the writers more credit for it, what if what we're seeing is Michael felt guilty about Rainer getting the boot and convinced herself and then Vance that she needed to make Rainer her XO, and now she's finding out that maybe it wasn't such a good idea after all, because, you know, all he needed was a little support and love and he'll be right as rain, and he's just not, he's just pushing back. I mean, there's been development, you know, he's certainly gotten a little cuddlier, but she's also kind of being real weird this semester, this season.
Your premise violates the prime directive of Michael is right. So no, it's not correct. Nice try.
Yeah,
I don't think that that's the case. I think that her reasons were genuine. I do think that there was some guilt on her part about, like, you know, he didn't deserve to just go out to pasture. Like, I do agree with that, but I don't think either of them, frankly, regret the decision. I do feel like there was more of a concerted effort to make him discovery friendly than is probably necessary. I don't even disagree with the idea of it. I think they've gone too far with it. Mm-hmm. Because, like, again, the whole idea was he's got this different perspective, and that is valuable, which I tend to agree with. So it would be, like, even in this episode, to jump ahead, she sent her message directly to him in order to save the day. But it was because she studied his culture. And I guess you could say that's a connection that they made. But it's not like she took his advice about something that she disagreed with. It's not like she digested something that he brought to her. And it's like, you know what? You're right. Which, I mean, maybe we're splitting hairs, but to me, that's different. I guess you could say that she trusted him to interpret the message and act accordingly, which, you know, that's great. But that's not the same as, all right, I don't know if I 100% agree with your call, but I'm going to go with it. But again, then again, I don't know if you should. If you're the captain, that's your XO. Like, it's your call. Michael is right. Star Trek, Michael is right. Season 2.
I'm interested in Rick's possible explanation that Michael is feeling guilty for what happened to Rainer and is trying to make amends by selecting him as XO. I am interested in Neek's idea that they are laying some groundwork for Michael to be called out as not behaving, you know, quote unquote, correctly throughout this season. I like both of those ideas, but no part of me thinks that there's any chance that either of those two are the case, because this is Star Trek. They would never, ever be able to set up that kind of plot angle without telegraphing it to the audience 7 episodes in advance. If Michael was going to be what was making these, you know, poor decisions, or the way that she's interacting with Rainer was going to come around or come back on her later this season as a lesson on how she was not doing things the way that she ought to have, they would be making that really obvious in like facial expressions or further discussion. They would have been doing that already. It would have been made clear to the audience, hey, keep an eye on this because it doesn't seem quite right. This might come back later. The classic, hey, remember this because it's going to be important later. That would be stamped across the episodes much earlier if they wanted to go that route. So to go back to what Nick was saying before, do the writers know what they're doing? They do. What we're seeing on the screen is what they're trying to say, why they've decided that these quote unquote lessons are what they want to try to get across in the dialogue, contrary to the characterizations that have been developed over the past 4 years. I don't know why they're making that decision, but I also agree with Neek. This show is not the only perpetrator.
What's contrary to the characterization?
Neek, why don't you take this
one? They're not... Michael is being pretty consistent with how she's always been, but I do take issue with, like, her being... Again, the gaslighting. Like, I really felt like she was stepping over the line the way she treated Rainer in that one scene. Like, it was... Like I said, like, we've never seen Michael be... That's not true. I was going to say we've never seen her be cruel. We have, because, and in fact, it all adds up, because I was about to accuse Michael of doing something that the Vulcans do, which is they act like they're right. They act like they've got the high ground when they're actually the ones being petty AF mother efforts. And Michael is definitely not going that far. She's not like on Sarek's level of like cruelty at this point. But by her acting as though she has the moral high ground, and it's like, oh, Rainer, you're... She was acting like that one Vulcan was towards Sisko in that baseball episode, you know? I mean, not that badly, but acting as though you're right when... Just so you can sort of, like, condescend and treat someone else poorly, that's a little bit what she was doing there. And like, I don't think the writers are doing this on purpose either. Like, I was asking the question... to spark a discussion, but I don't think the writers know what they're doing there. And so, yet somehow they stumbled upon something genius because they're making her act like a Vulcan, and she was raised by Vulcans, so there you have it.
I wouldn't go so far as, I don't think she was being cruel. To me, cruel means you know it's not the case and you're trying to make somebody else believe that it is the case. I do think she genuinely believes.
Right, like she believes what she's saying.
Yeah. I don't think she's trying to... I don't think she's trying to convince him of something that she doesn't think is true.
Yeah.
So I guess to me it falls short of cruel, but I do think that it's myopic, and that's why I was asking Scott. Like, I don't think it's necessarily out of character. It's just disappointing for a character that we've seen grow and evolve to act as though she hasn't.
Yeah.
I do think we should move on, though, because I think we've been talking about this one scene for about 20 minutes now.
Yeah, I figured now would be time to move to what happens next, the opening credits of the episode. No. No, we haven't even gotten there yet, because there's still more that happens. They get into the shuttle, and they make it through the aperture into this interdimensional space pocket. They see Mal and Locke's ship busted in half. And then I got distracted because Tom is having a little fun in the Zoom chat, because that's not distracting. We'll cut all that out. So they make it through the aperture. They see the busted ship, and then they come upon the ominous letters ISS. Oh my God, what's it going to be? I already knew because Sean put it in the chat, and I couldn't avert my eyes quick enough, so I knew what was coming. They find They find the ISS Enterprise. And immediately they say, let's get onto that ship and find the clue. But the question I had, and let me know, please, panelists, if I missed something, why assume that the clue is on the Enterprise?
Well, it's a good idea for where to start. They find something unexpected in the that interdimensional space. So, I mean, where else would you go look?
They had already dodged debris from some unknown vessel, and then they found Malin Locke's ship, and now they find a third ship. Who knows how much is in this interdimensional pocket?
My thinking was Malin Locke's ship was damaged, and they're like, okay, well, there's no way they, you know, like basically the only place they could have gone is this large ship. That was the only place that they likely would be there. That was the only place they could go. And so they got on the ship and they scanned for life signs and they were there. So yes, they were looking for the artifact, but they're also, and arguably more so, pursuing Malin and Locke. So I was fine with that.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that the question I came up with was pretty thin, but still, I wasn't sure if there was something else that I missed in the episode that indicated this is where you're supposed to look. But they immediately, they were proceeding as though, oh, we know for sure, it's right here. And I just didn't know why. But why go there? Well, because it's the Enterprise and it's going to be a badass set. And we want to see Discovery action on Strange New Worlds soundstage. So let's do it. Credits. And then we get the credits. And then we're into the episode. As we proceed through the episode, there's A-plot 1, there's A-plot 2, and then there's B-plot. A-plot 1 is on the Enterprise. A-plot 2 is the flashback scenes that are contained within those. And then B-plot is back on Discovery with trying to do the science to restore communications, to show us that Culber has something on his mind. And eventually the rescue of Burnham and company from space. So let's take those one at a time. The action on board the Enterprise. They find Malin Locke. They have their discussions. Book does get to have his heart-to-heart with Mal, who is, because I've been using this descriptor this entire season as we discuss it, talking about her in a very CW fashion. It was the least CW that I've seen Mal so far this season, and that I really enjoyed. We got to see more of her character, including some history, but also like more aspects, different shades of her personality, which was a pleasant change. I like that. What did you guys think about anything and everything that happened on the Enterprise throughout that plot thread? Tom, let's start with you.
That plot thread of them just searching for Malin Locke and
in the searching for them, including the sick bay standoff, the trip to the bridge, the fight, and the escape.
Just not the backstory stuff. Well, okay, the first one that still got me, I couldn't figure out who was stuck where in that sickbay fight scene. Like, I assumed it was like Book stuck behind in a cubby of some sort, and then he walks out and leaves. So I had a little confusion with that, with the visuals, but just going through the Enterprise like they did and trying to tie in with the previous Mirror Universe episodes, I thought they were really trying to they're trying to get a lot of threads together and kind of tie them off and weave them together with the, you know, having Saru as the rebel Kelpian leader, and his association, and then you've got all the way back to Mir and trying to put it all in. I don't know, they could have. Let me back up. What was it? Sean's comment in the chat about having a Mir universe mention and not have it be a Mir universe episode?
I don't remember him. I don't remember the message that you're referring to.
Okay. Or
I saw someone. Can I interrupt for a second?
Yeah.
I'm hearing like clicking noises. Does someone have like a washing machine or dryer going or something?
Yes. Sorry.
I don't know. I don't know if like it's going to be picked up on the recording, but if it is, that's like problematic.
Maybe no, this is a little better.
It's Tom.
It seems better to me, Tom.
Yeah, I don't hear it now. Okay, so sorry. Carry on, Tom.
But you guys can still hear me, all right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. With the Mir universe stuff, I was going to say that they could have spent a little more time on that backstory to explain a little bit more how they got to that point and how the Enterprise got there, but then that would have turned this into just another Mir universe episode. I liked what we saw in there. I think they could have made that backstory, that A2 plot, a little bit neater. But for what we had in that A1 plot with the Enterprise, I liked what we got to see, and just outside of a few confusing bits in there. So that's probably just me and my attention span.
I was also confused about who was where until they both left, but I was watching it on my phone. So I just on my phone on the train. So I just chalked it up to me not paying close enough attention.
A question that came to my mind, you know, once again, a patented, I probably just missed something or I'm misremembering it. Regardless, it's a very small detail that doesn't matter. Question. That's my bailiwick. When they're looking at the dedication plaque and they realize that a Kelpian had led these refugees on this ship to revolt against and escape the Terran Empire, and they say, oh, it must have been Saru. Am I misremembering that in the mirror arc of season one, Empress Georgiou had Saru killed and cooked, and they ate him at that banquet scene? Rick, you're muted.
I think they ate
another Kelpian.
Yeah, they didn't eat Saru.
It was a different Kelpian.
Okay. I think my assumption comes from the fact that Saru, in those mirror universe episodes of season one, was the only Kelpian that we saw, unless I'm mistaken.
We saw three other Kelpians. They were lined up in a row, and I guess Georgiou like told Michael, choose one of them. And Michael didn't know what she was choosing. She was like, that one? And then that's the one they end up eating.
Okay.
None of them were Saru. They were just rando Kelpians.
Oh. Never mind.
Now, I thought you were going to say, did Michael have any evidence that it was actually Saru? No, she did not. It could have been another Kelpian. But Michael is right.
Yeah, Michael is always right. So, yes, we have to make that assumption. I'm fine with it. I guess I'm bad at remembering stuff. I thought that they ate Saru, which made the banquet scene that much more terrifying for me. But I guess it wasn't as bad as I thought, looking back all those years.
No, in fact, later on, Saru became Georgiou's personal hairdresser and stuff.
Totally missed that. This is what happens when you don't go back and rewatch the seasons, because I have not gone back and rewatched the seasons. So that's on me.
My problem was, oh, go ahead.
Well, if you're going to go off of that, then do it, because I was going to move on to an Easter egg hunt.
I liked the fact that they broke Michael and Maul up and Book, or Michael and Locke and Book and Maul up. I like their interactions. I like the fact that it wasn't just pew pew pew. It was like talking and listening and stuff. The thing that got me is, if the clue was on the ship, which is what appears it is, how did that happen?
They explained it. Are you talking about how did the clue get onto the ship?
Yeah.
So I think it was Dr. Cho,
yes,
who was from the Mirror Universe, and she was part of the crew of the ISS Enterprise. They came to our universe,
mm-hmm,
and did whatever, and she left the Enterprise. They all left the Enterprise.
Yeah.
And went on to do things. She ended up joining Starfleet. She became friends with the Ramo guy who writes that diary, as well as, you know, the Trill dude and whoever else is in that club. And then at some point,
General Little Rascals.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, it's not just the Romulan who's planting clues. It's this whole group. And so she's part of that group planting clues. So at some point she's like, oh, I have a great place where we can hide a clue. It's like, it's an Enterprise from a totally different universe. And it's okay, in this weird aperture. Isn't that a cool place to hide something? And the Ramu guy is like, yeah, that's super cool. And so they go and hide it. And then they scrub their identities from the Tron.
Okay. I didn't get any of that. So
when you say, I'm sorry, when you say the Tron, is that
the internet
Canadian
club
for the internet? It's, is that Canadian, or is that just you?
It's not Canadian. It's just based off of the movie Tron.
Okay. Oh, okay.
I've been wondering that all episode.
I just had to clarify, is this a Canadian thing or is this a unique thing?
It's
unique?
It's unique.
Yay.
I can't take credit for it. I stole it from a friend of a friend, but yeah.
Excuse me just a moment.
When I go back, I'm moving on to the Easter egg hunt. This is a very small thing, but if I go back and rewatch this episode, I'm going to scrutinize every frame that we see of sick bay, because I want to see if they included in the set dressing an acid stain on the counter that McCoy spotted in Mirror Mirror, saying, I spilled acid here a year ago.
Have fun with that.
That's going to be one of those deep cuts, and I'll look for that for sure.
I think you'd be better off looking for the holo projector in Strange New Worlds.
Right? Why was there a holo projector in sickbay?
For the EMH, of course.
The EMH has not been invented yet.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's his point.
Hologram technology has.
That's my point as well. That freaking bugged me.
Well, it goes back to one of the, what do we call it? The temporal technological inconsistencies that have cropped up owing to the fact that Star Trek is being made now in the 2020s, or in the 2010s and 2020s, where, we're going to have holograms because that's cool special effects.
No, obviously that's the real world explanation, but the Trek explanation is because this isn't exactly the original timeline, because what was the name of that episode where Lon and Kirk have con shenanigans?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And they made it clear that there's like, you know, a billion different timelines, and they're just trying to get to the closest approximation of the original timeline.
Mm.
Well, and they also, you know, we don't know exactly, unless they put a star date on there, we don't know exactly when this happened, but it was sometime in the TNG DS9 era, right? So they were developing the EMH. No? Why not?
No. The TNG DS9 era, by then, the Terran Empire had fallen and the Klingon-Cardassian alliance had risen. So this would have had to be in the TOS era. Now, why would they have holoprojectors? We didn't see them used in TOS because we didn't have the special effects technology back then, but ships did have holographic projectors all over the place, as we've seen in early episodes of Discovery that were still in the 23rd century. And it was
Pike who said he didn't want it anymore.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. It was Pike who said, I don't like this hologram stuff. I want screens. Get these projectors out of here. So maybe in the mirror universe, Pike liked holograms and said, leave the projectors.
Well, and that's the other thing. I mean, just because the USS Enterprise didn't have an EMH doesn't mean the ISS Enterprise didn't, or right. have some other need for holos in the sick bay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. USS Enterprise didn't have walk-in food storage for the Kelpian crew. I'm sorry. We should move on.
The other thing that was mentioned in, when they're doing their mirror universe history lesson, they say that after the Terran High Chancellor was assassinated for the reforms that were instituted, does anyone think that the High Chancellor was Spock?
Yes. I think that's clear, right?
Yes.
That's what I was thinking.
I mean, clear to the people who are familiar with
yes.
the stuff we've seen in previous episodes, not made
yes.
clear to, like, say, a newcomer in this.
Correct. Movie. Correct.
Yeah. Yeah, but, like, a newcomer is not going to care about any of that stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
But, yeah.
So it's an Easter egg, indeed.
Yeah. I went through... I visited Memory Beta to see if Spock being a Terran High Chancellor was something that they pulled from non-canon material. And I had no idea how many different variations of the Mirror Universe have come up in Beta canon. There's a whole Mirror Universe timeline from an RPG source book. There's comic book storyline. There's books and novels in their own storyline. There's a lot of different, like, alternate mirror universes. It kind of blew my mind. That will be never a supplementary episode of this podcast.
It's almost like canon means almost nothing.
And that's canon.
That's canon.
Anyone else have thoughts or comments on the onboard the Enterprise scenes?
So what do we think about Book? I don't want to say ignoring, I don't know, being kind of dismissive of Maul's experience with her own father, to be like, well, that's not the guy I knew. Your father was great to me. Therefore, your experience is invalid.
It really, like, seemed...
I'm exaggerating, but... Mm.
I feel like he got close to that line, but at the end he was like, look, it sounded like he was a shitty father to you. I acknowledge that. And I'm sorry about that. But I also knew this about him. So I feel like he walked right up to, I'm dismissing your experience. But at the end he was like, I get it. But also this, which is fine. I'm fine with it. I would have expected him to be a little more empathetic, since he's, you know, literally empathetic, but he got there eventually.
Mm-hmm. Mm. It seemed a lot like in their exchanges, they were talking at each other and not quite as much to each other up until closer to the end, where they finally, to a degree, connected, not enough where they're going to try to be friends or work together, but enough where she put down her double gun stance and decided to work together to get the others out. I was a little surprised that he said, like, almost verbatim what he told Michael. I might say this, I might say that, I might say that. And then he said, like, all of that exactly. Anything else?
Yeah.
All right. Now let's shift our attention to the flashback scenes. Tropes and predictable stuff. And a notable lack of extreme cold temperatures which is surprising because it's bitter cold on Breen.
Is it?
According to Gul Dukat, I hear it's bitter cold on Breen. They like the cold.
But didn't Wayun say
unless
like
that's
like it's actually quite comfortable.
Oh, damn it. Look, you did it again. You reminded me of something else that I forgot. Damn it.
So it's like kind of like a myth that Breen is inhospitable. But also they weren't on Breen, right? They were like, it was like a ship or a station or something.
Yeah, it was probably an outpost or something. I thought that I was onto something. Said, wait a minute. I thought that Breen liked the cold. They should be someplace cold and it's not cold, but I'm wrong. And you know what? Next time you host this podcast. It's extra funny. It's extra funny because I asked her to host next week.
I had a lot of issues with that flashback. But like, why do they have all their interactions, Maul and Locke, like right out in the open where there's tons of other stormtroopers walking around? Like, just go into a room, go into her ship, like go anywhere. Like he's so reluctant to remove his helmet, and then he does it like in plain view of everyone. Like what?
Well, behind force fields, remember they're behind a cloaking shield when he takes off his helmet. A cloaking shield that is controlled by a button that's on the outside of the cloaking.
Yeah,
shield.
That literally anyone can open.
Yeah,
yes.
They should have had an entire episode. Focus. If they were going to do this backstory, they should have had an entire episode for it. It should have been more nuanced and more build up. Because, like, I know, you know, Rick is on board with them. And he's like, see, they're not evil. They're sympathetic. They're great kids. To me, this did not make them sympathetic. If anything, it made it worse. Like, because like at every stage they were actively choosing the wrong path. Like they made their bed. Like you gotta lie in it, bro. Like I don't know. I actually don't dislike Maul or Locke. I find them interesting enough. I actually, of all the villains we've had in Disco, they're probably my faves, because they are a bit more nuanced. Like, they're not just, you know, mustache twirly evil. But I'm very done with the trope of a redemption arc for a villain. Because, you know, Rick, I think at the top of the show, you're like, see? You know, they're not bad, but it's like, yes, they are. Two things can be true. They can be victims. They can have good reasons for doing their bad things and still do bad things and still need to go to jail.
And I know I don't dispute that at all. Although something I found, and I put it in the chat last week, but I just want to say it real quick here on the show. When I rewatched the one where they were unstuck in time.
Face the Strange.
Thank you, Face the Strange. And it was, you know, 15 hours earlier, and they straight up murder that dude. Mm-hmm. The one line I missed was, she said, "It's coated with the latinum is coated with a blah blah poison, the same poison you sold to the Emerald Chain to use on people like me."
Yeah, it was revenge on her part.
Yeah,
but that doesn't make it okay.
Wow.
Like you just because someone's a murderer and then you murdered them doesn't make you a good guy.
And I'm not saying, like, they're good guys.
You're not meant to be on Dexter's side. Dexter is a villain.
I will also say he didn't murder anybody. He sold weapons to the people who did it, which is literally what they are doing. They are trying to find a weapon to sell it to the highest bidder. This is great. Jeez. Keep going, Rick.
Never cross Rick. He will straight up kill you.
I don't dislike Maul and Locke either. I agree that the backstory is kind of predictable and cookie cutter. I would not want a whole episode. Maybe more nuanced, that would be fine, but I don't want a whole episode of that. But I agree with you also, Neek, in that there should have been, you know, a nice little Dances with Wolves montage where you see them sneaking around and trying to not get caught and eventually get caught because they're in the middle of this criminal syndicate. That would have been fine. But, like, no, they, for them to be, like, I wouldn't even call them criminal masterminds. For them to be, like, majorly sneaky people, they were not sneaky in the slightest.
Yeah, and it, I mean, clearly there were budget issues. So the fact that it, you know, was the ISS Enterprise just so they could use the Strange New World set. And they had, they built one set for all the Breen stuff. Because Mullen Locke's interactions should not have been happening on that set. They should have been elsewhere. So clearly there has to have been a budget concern that they had every conversation happen in that one space.
They could have, they didn't need to be, as you said, they could have just gone into a shuttle. They could have gone into some empty shuttle somewhere and just shown, you know, had a shot of the outside of the shuttle, which is not a budget thing because it's CG. And then cut to them, a close up of the two of them inside the shuttle.
Well, CG is expensive.
I think they've got a picture of a shuttle. I'm just saying. I'm gonna guess.
Well, if it's not budget, not flying around, not shooting things.
Just a shuttle in a hangar.
I mean, I'm not disagreeing.
Or just
like
the two of them, like
it was a failure, is what I'm saying.
Nice that you found this shuttle for
like
canoodle within.
Well, that's it. Like it just didn't work. It didn't make sense. The like the physical locations in which they were having their canoodling, as you call it, did not make sense. And so the flashbacks were just tropey, unconvincing. And like I wanted them to work. Like I wanted that backstory. But I don't know, it was poorly executed, unfortunately.
And I don't disagree with you at all about that.
They worked well enough for me. Like they got the point across. This is why they're doing it. That's really all I needed from it. I didn't expect to like them more. I would have been genuinely surprised if there was some backstory that made me, oh wow, okay, I can really get behind these. Like, no, it was about what I figured it would be.
That's the problem. You know, it, like Scott said at the top, you know, there were no surprises. It was exactly what we all expected, and like that's bad storytelling that none of us are. So, with the exception of the reveals about like the two-faced thing regarding the Breen, and I agree with you, Rick, that, and so you know, you mentioned this is a you thing, this is a me thing, because the Breen are so mysterious. Probably a lot of us fans have done our own, you know, fanfics in our own minds, whether we've written them down or not, about what we think the Breen are all about. And so, you know, I have like a whole backstory for the Breen. And so, you know, none of this conforms to that. So I'm just sort of like, oh, that's too bad. Like, I would have preferred if they never told us anything about the Breen so that I could just like, because the mystery is interesting. The mystery revealed, not so much. But that having been said, I do think that whole two-faced thing is interesting. And it does go some way towards explaining why they're in those suits. And so I don't know if they're going to give us more on that. I hope they do, because that part was interesting to me. I'm not sure exactly what they're trying to say with it. And so, okay, was the implication that they're, because they said something along the lines of like, are my real face versus my false face? Which face is the real one? The one that looks all crystalline, or the normal one?
I think it's the Jell-O one.
The crystalline one is the second layer, the more false face. The most real face, I think, is the one that.
The face that there is, like, I don't know what word to use, honor or. The face you're meant to show, I guess, is that jelly face.
Mm-hmm.
But does that make it the true face or the false face?
That's the true face. The false face is what we have seen on Locke so far.
I took it the other way. That's interesting.
See, that's the thing. It could be interpreted either way. And so, and I wasn't exactly sure what it was. And so all that to say, I really hope we get more on that because it's confusing to me at this point.
Yeah, so do I.
I think we will.
Here's how I take it. The Primarch is not going to put on a false face because he considers it weakness. So when he opens up his helmet and we see the, it's either it's crystalline or it's fluidic, he's showing the real face because he's not going to put on a fake one because it's weak. The other evidence is the first time we saw Locke take off his helmet several episodes ago, we saw a flash of his true Breen face before he put his fake skin face in place.
Yes, yes. But so the implication, and correct me or if you have a different interpretation, but the implication is that the helmet maintains that jelly face, no?
I think the helmet just hides it because the Primarch mentioned that it takes effort to wear a skin face. So if you wear the helmet, you don't have to put in the effort.
Oh, I almost took it the other way around.
They have their true face, but they wear helmets all the time, so no one else can see it. Tom, you got something.
So I'm looking at the quotes from that scene. And
oh, sorry, producer Tom, what do you got?
Yes, thank you. Locke says, you know, why can we change? Both faces are part of us. If we deny half our nature, we deny it all. And the Primarch says, we have evolved past the need for that form. Holding it makes you, and he's talking the skin face, you know, holding it makes you unfocused, inflexible, and weak. So this could answer a lot of things that we've talked about. The differences in established canon of the Breen, sorry, John, canon, the established Breen canon from DS9, and, well, you know, that they're evolving, so that it is different from that. But also this jello face, it says it's making you unfocused. So it's,
but the skin face is making them unfocused, right?
Yeah. Implying the jello face, takes more effort to do that.
See, what? I interpreted that differently. Ah, that's like, more interesting.
So here's how I'm having the exact opposite interpretation.
I took it that, basically they can move between the two. They can move between their natural resting face, which is the more solid green face that we've seen on him like throughout the season, and the more fluid face, which is the face that's directly underneath the helmet. And if someone has seen a Breen face, they've seen that one. That's the face that they show because they're frankly harder to identify. Because I think it was this episode, Burn was like, oh, you're Breen? Whereas if he had had the jelly face, she might have recognized that as a Breen face, because presumably that's more.
Yeah, cold. And because...
So, and I took, it makes you inflexible, almost more, not that he's physically, I mean, I guess to a degree, physically inflexible, but as it being symbolic of... It is not our way. That is, we have decided not to be this rigid thing. We have decided to be this dynamic thing. And so true and false, I did not take to be constants. I think that they were having an argument, a more philosophical argument. This is my true face. Well, no, they're both our true faces. That's how I took that. So I wouldn't set it as a rule because the Primarch, you said, said that this is the true face. I don't think that is like biologically factual. I think that's his belief. And
yes, I agree. The implication was that it's like less a biological thing and more a cultural thing.
Right.
But I found it interesting because, you know, Maul said, "Show me your face," and Locke was like, "You've already seen my face," and she's like, "No, the other one." And so that
your real face, she says, right. No, your real face.
Yeah. So that to me implied that the jelly face is a put on and that the, you know, regular humanoid face is the one that's easy to maintain.
And it might also,
the jelly one is the one that takes effort.
And it might also be she's calling that the real face because that's the one he keeps hidden. You know, like we say, show me your true self. You know, well, it's not that you're, it's not like the self that you've seen has been a lie, but if it's the part of me that you haven't seen, and you say, show me your true self, show me the real you, do you mean the part that you haven't seen yet?
If I may usurp Scott's speculation corner, which we really should have a jingle for whenever it's introduced, the Breen, having been allied with the Dominion in DS9, they're now, they've got some intermixing going on, and so that's what we're seeing is this, a little bit of the founders in there.
You think that is not crazy. That with the Primarch saying that we have evolved past the need for that form, you think that the way they evolved is some limited interspecies commingling with changelings?
In some
pronounced canoodling.
Not saying you think that, but saying that you wonder if it's a possibility. And well done on Scott's speculation corner, because of course that thought already occurred to me.
I like that. That's interesting.
It
never occurred to me that humanoids and changelings could be compatible. So that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't even necessarily be like, oh, they had hybrid offspring, but it could be that some select Breen during the Dominion War were say augmented or altered with changeling DNA for some reason, and that has persisted and spread
we've already established in Picard that changelings there are mutated changelings that are more stable, quote unquote stable, and that can pass all the DNA tech. So in theory, yeah, they can reproduce.
But to me, it implies that the Breen have been, I don't know, changeling adjacent well before aligning themselves with the Dominion, because they've been wearing these suits well before they met the Dominion.
Except DS9, they established those were refrigeration suits.
Well, just because someone said that doesn't mean that that's what it was.
I feel like you should celebrate because you've rekindled the mystery. So the thing that you thought you had lost, you have found. You can make up whatever you want. All fixed. All works.
I think the suits and the masks, the fact that the Breen don't let people see what they really look like was probably something. If we are presuming this speculation for the moment, they already were keeping themselves a mystery to outsiders, but the introduction of changeling DNA into their species, carrying through 800 years to the 32nd century to where now they have two faces, I think those can be separate things that came together. I don't think that the suits and the masks have to always be because they are changeling adjacent. I see where you're going with it. I just don't think it's necessary. I think that they could say, well, we're already in these suits and masks, and now we have another reason, another thing to hide behind them.
And I also think like they're definitely going to revisit this whole discussion, because the whole, you know, the big climax is them going back to the Breen to present the, you know, the artifact, the fully completed artifact. So the most, you know, guys, going back to your original question, the part of that I found most interesting of the flashbacks was the, and I don't remember what they called it, but the blood war,
The blood bounty. Yeah, I forgot the Breen word for it. It starts with an L.
Ariga?
Oh, yeah, it starts with an E. God, yeah, how can I be more wrong this episode? Ariga, yes.
That, to me, was like the most interesting part. Was, okay, so this is the thing. This is the why. And this is, like, I liked it. I liked, that was probably my favorite part of the scene. He's like, you know what this means? Like, yeah, I know what it means. And he shot him in the leg. That was favorite part of that.
That gave them shades of Orions, and also they're green, which is also shades of Orion. So I wonder if there's something there as well. If there's some relation between Breen and Orion's.
I could see it. The shades aren't terribly dissimilar. But with Locke shooting the Primarch very deliberately in the shoulder, and them making it clear, you know, why didn't you kill him? Because he raised me. That's the guy that they're going to be dealing with closer to the end of the season, when inevitably Mal and Locke get the tech first. They're going to go to the Primarch and try to use that tech to get out from under the thing that I already forgot the name of. And
yes. Iriga.
And we'll have to, you know, our heroes will have to stop them from giving the tech over to the Breen.
Well, the Breen will get the tech, but our heroes will stop them with the help of Mal and Locke to complete their redemption arc. Possibly in their dying moments.
Okay, John, change your name to Michael, because you're right. You're always right.
Funny story, my middle name is Michael. It's not, but if I say it, it is, then it is.
That's canon.
Always right.
And finally, looking at the time, it is now time to get on to the last little bit, because there wasn't a whole lot. Oh, Tom's got something. What do you got?
Sorry. And this is something I said in the our opening statements. The flashbacks really flipped the script for me on Mal and Locke. Through the previous episodes, you know, you had Locke was just so enamored, so in love with Mal. You know, that's all he's there for, is because he loves her. And I was just suspecting that it wasn't reciprocated, that she was there. She was saying she was in love with him just to kind of keep going and until it ran out. And I thought for sure we would have an episode where she would turn around and go, no, you were a meal ticket. You were just, you know, my ride, and, you know, shoot him or something. But the flashbacks really show that that's not the case, or at least it really, I don't foresee that happening.
You're right, because the Iriga is on Locke. So the fact that Mal is sticking with him means she really does love him.
Yeah.
And so, he's sticking with her because they made it clear he doesn't. The reason he got busted down to working on at the dock is he doesn't fit the mold. So even though it ended up being due to the Iriga, if he had decided right when she said, come with me, if he had just said, okay, let's go right now, they could have gotten on the ship and left before the Primarch got there, and he would have been free of that. But that's not how it happened. Either way, he would have been able to escape this uncomfortable life amongst Breen that he does not fit in with. He doesn't agree with their ideology, apparently, or their philosophy. And even though they're on the run for their lives, he is still out of that situation. That is why he's never going to turn his back on her, because she, however it ended up happening, gave him a way out of that situation. And their current situation might subjectively be worse, but it's not where he was before. So he'll stick with her forever for that.
Well, and I think he does. I don't think it's just like an obligation. I think he does. I think they are genuinely in love. You know, it is not a healthy love, but, you know, I don't think their feelings are ulterior.
No, I really just was seeing it as very one-sided earlier, and I don't anymore. So it's, I think, though, that that's going to play into what I think Meek is one who said she doesn't want to see the redemption story for a villain. So, I mean, I know I'm getting tired of those too. So I think that's going to this relationship, the honest love between the two of them is going to play into that. So
it's definitely going to happen.
Yeah. I think these two are redeemable, though. I think they are redeemable. I think that there will have to be consequences. It's not like they're going to be made Federation presidents or anything.
No, they're going to die. Yep. Does that work for you, Neek?
No.
They're going to die saving the universe from the danger that they put the universe in.
Yeah, I disagree.
No, I don't like that.
I don't think that's where it's going to go. I think that they're going to be instrumental in solving the problem. And then
agreed.
Take their lumps.
And go to Federation jail.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily think that will happen, but that's what I want to happen. I want them to go to jail.
All right, we're going to
hang out with Tom Paris.
We're putting this to the listeners. Okay.
We dare you to disagree with us.
Mal and Locke, are they going to die heroic deaths to save the universe?
Yes.
Are they going to help save the universe and go to a Federation prison? Are they going to help save the universe and make it to the Gamma Quadrant? Listeners, let us know. Neek? No, this is for the listeners. Stop. Listeners, let us know what you think about that.
Or Gamma Quadrant or Mirror Universe. They can hide
no,
out there.
Like,
they're not going back
those
to
options,
Mirror Universe.
Those options are fine. I just wanted to, that just reminded me, it's like, okay, Maul goes, she's clearly traumatized by, like, her shitty dad, and goes to, like, much detail to explain to Book how terrible her father is, and yet she still believes his story about how there's a paradise in the Gamma Quadrant? Like, what?
I found that odd as well, but it is where she seems to be trying to go.
I also found it odd. Well, I think... I didn't rewatch it, but I thought that the paradise was real. Like she's well traveled at this point. The place is real, but the father has died. I think that's what I remember being the case. I could be wrong.
It raises
the question: was her dad making up that story, and she just chooses to believe it, or? Was she let down by the fact that he didn't take her there, so she's going to go on her own? I do not know the answer.
I took it as the latter. Like he knew that the heat was on him, and his life, ironically, that she's ended up in this situation. But like he didn't bring his family with him because he knew that what that life would mean. They would always be on the run. They would always be looking over his shoulder, and he didn't want that for them. And so he effectively abandoned them. In his mind, for their own good. That's what I thought. I didn't think that the place wasn't real. He just didn't bring them.
Mm.
No, we don't know how much time has elapsed between those flashbacks and present day. So it could be at the time of the flashbacks when she's talking about going to that colony, she wasn't so against her father. You know, if you'd asked her about her dad, she'd whatever. You know. Haven't seen him in a while.
She was abandoned. Her mother died when she was 14, and her father abandoned them well before that. So she was a child when her dad abandoned them. So, right. So you're saying that she's like hasn't seen her father in 10 years, and just in the past like 2 years, she's decided he's a jerk.
Well, or something happened that you know. So she may not now. In present day,
this
colony.
I reject your headcanon for that. Okay.
One of these days, I want to hear a supercut of Neek versus the panel. Just all the different times where Neek has just slapped us the fuck down.
One of all these right. days. That's the show. That's every episode.
Just the series of me disagreeing with y'all.
It would be a long
in the best way.
All right, now on to the B plot, and there's so little to it that really the only thing that I want to talk about is Culber.
Mm.
Now we get a conversation between Culber and Tilly at the end of the episode in the bar, where Culber doesn't know how to feel about all of the massive experiences that he's had in the past several years. And he specifically mentions how he is not able to talk with his husband about them because of their difference in perspective. And I'm going to invoke the Neek cap, because Neek, you mentioned in your recap on your website that they have been indicating all season long how Culber doesn't have much truck with religion. So I was hoping that you could, I want your take first on Culber, where Culber is right now and how we got here.
Yeah. So I didn't catch it until this episode that's what those little, telegraphing moments were leading up to, that he's having like a crisis of faith. I mean, don't ask me to tell you which episodes, but in two previous episodes this season, Culber has mentioned his abuela and how she, you know, had icons in her house of like every religion imaginable. And he was sort of, in one episode, he says something along the lines of like, oh, I don't remember. It was something sort of dismissive of his abuela, like something sort of, he was like mocking her spiritualism. And then in a subsequent episode, he mentioned that she had all this iconography of various religions. And I noticed both of those because I'm like, that's a really, it was like very shoehorned into the dialogue. And I was like, why does he keep talking about his grandmother? Like, that's so random. It doesn't quite fit the scene. And so it just stuck in my mind and I didn't worry about it. So then in this episode, where Tilly suggests that, you know, he's on a spiritual journey, and he's like, no, I'm not. I don't like religion at all. And it's like, oh, okay. That's what it was about. It was about him doth protesting too much and saying he doesn't care about religion, when what he's really doing is like yelling to the rafters, guys, I'm having a spiritual crisis. Please give me something to believe in. And so I'm guessing his arc this season is that this progenitor stuff is going to be the answer to his spiritual journey. So that's why I sort of speculated that, oh, is he going to become like a monk of sorts for the progenitors or something? Or maybe it's not going to be about the progenitors at all. And it's, you know, he's going to, I don't know. I feel like they're setting him up to become some sort of religious figure. And he may or may not leave Stamets. I don't know. Go ahead. You're going to say something?
Only pointing out that for someone who has never believed much in religion and as an extension, a higher power, as they reach the end of this chase and find the leftover technology, the evidence, perhaps even some survivors of their progenitor race, it could be for Culber the closest he's ever going to find to a higher power, to a creator.
Yeah, because the progenitors basically our gods, right?
Yeah, the literal creators. Us.
Yeah.
If that's the direction that they're going, then I'm fascinated to see how they further develop that.
I didn't see any indication that he was thinking of leaving Paul. That just that this is a thing that he didn't feel that he could really relate to or talk to him about. But I didn't see that as like an issue. I mean, I guess it's an issue if there's a thing you can't communicate about. But we might need to split up kind of. I didn't see it that way. Maybe
so here's my thing. Like I don't think it is necessary to leave your spouse if you have different religious beliefs. But seeing as how in a previous episode, Adira and Gray broke up for very dubious reasons, like now I'm thinking like, oh, is that sort of setting the groundwork for like, if you don't have the exact same values as your spouse, you shouldn't be together? Like, is this all just like a political thing where it's like, you know, left versus right? Like, I mean, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it feels like...
Those are teenagers who are dating. This is a married couple of
Again, I agree with you. That is a ridiculous reason to leave a spouse. But as we've already discussed, these writers are weird. And I'm like, are they trying to say something? Like, I don't know. Obviously, all we have to do is watch the rest of the season to find out. So
I think it's much more likely that they will just have to figure out how to communicate with each other and talk about this, because Culber is having trouble wrapping his head around things that don't really have an answer and trying to make sense of it. And Paul has a hard time talking about things that you can't just figure out the answers to. That seems to be Culber's difficulty in taking it to Paul, because for the scientist who always needs to have answers, try to come to him with a subject that doesn't have answers, and the two of them might have difficulty communicating about that. That's what I picked up on. So they'll have to figure out how to talk about these people with vastly different perspectives on uncertainty. How are they going to talk about it?
Now that I think about it,
and Rick, I'm coming back to you, so hold that.
They've also been telegraphing that Stamets is also having sort of like a bit of a crisis. Like his whole thing about legacy and his outsized enthusiasm for the progenitor situation. So maybe the whole progenitor, whatever the final thing is that all the clues are leading to, maybe that'll be, you know, a coming together of Stamets and Culber.
Mm.
I know, Rick, I'm just going to interject this really quick. I also don't think that they're going to split up, because they've already done that on the show. They've already had the thing where Hugh has gone through his, his crisis of faith or unwheel, whatever you want to call it, and split from Paul, and they've reconnected. And it would be
dumb to do it again, yeah.
Yeah, it'd be dumb to do it again.
So in the conversation Hugh has with Tilly, they established that neither Paul nor Hugh like situation where they both
don't
hate
have
the unknown.
Answers. Yeah, yeah.
But then Tilly says, "Hang on, they're really not that far apart. The intellectual and the spiritual both reach for understanding. Both bring us to new places." And then Hugh says, "But I didn't say spiritual." And Tilly says, "Yeah, Hugh, you kind of did." And I think it's interesting that they're putting the character who is going to be going on to Starfleet Academy is the one kind of stepping away from the humanism of Star Trek.
And you mean stepping away from the humanism of Star Trek as in I don't know how to word it, but like acknowledging and no, I'm having trouble with this sentence. Acknowledging a spirituality or a spiritual way of looking at things rather than
scientific. That's what she's saying to Hugh. What you're talking about is spirituality, because Hugh's like, I didn't say that. And Tilly's like, yeah, you did.
Yeah, no, you're making a good point, Rick, that presumably if this Starfleet Academy show happens, you know, Tilly is the continuing character. And so the fact that they're making her the one who's pro-spirituality, that says something about the direction that Trek overall is going in.
Maybe. Or maybe it's just a throwaway. Just part of Hugh's journey. But
there are no throwaways in Star Trek.
That's true.
There are tons.
Well, there are things we can throw away, but nothing is put in without purpose.
I think that's true, but I don't take that to mean that every sentence is as multi-layered as we make it.
Every sentence is as multi-layered as I make it.
That's another one for the Neek Argues clip show, a.k.a. the show.
So, did anybody catch the 47 in this episode?
I did not. Where is it?
Mm-mm. When Michael sends the tractor beam through the aperture and starts modulating it to make the numbers, she's referencing section 4, verse 7 of that poet,
whatever poem.
Of the Kelleran poem. Yep.
Yeah.
Mm. Ah, that.
That, God, that was so dumb.
Sneaky. That was a sneaky one.
Why did she send a Kelleran poem when she could literally just send a
send a message?
Send like a standard Starfleet. If you can't send a voice file, just like a standard, like Morse code, like anything that the average Starfleet officer will understand. Why make it difficult for them?
Because they all have to understand each other. Totally.
Oh my God. Really.
Because it was showing her faith
in Rainer.
Yeah. Like, she was showing anyone can get this, but I know that you will get this. That's why you're in charge. You're the one. This message is for you. You need to get this before anybody else.
And also be impressed with how well I know the Battle of Kull.
Yeah. Also that.
Exactly.
I think about Krull. I don't know the thing. Look how well I know your poem.
And I know maybe it was just the first thing she thought of, and.
But there should be a standard thing.
Presumably,
there's a standard procedure for such situations.
Okay, but what? That is not a standard situation.
Yes, it is. How often in Star Trek have they been in situations where they have to send? Like a code rather than a verbal message. It happens all the time.
Right, but it's usually a thing that's like we have X amount of time before the aperture closes. Not it's opening and closing. You know, like
what difference does that make?
Because like you can't I don't know.
Look at you trying to defend Star Trek.
I can't defend it much, but I did I didn't mind it. It was it was a cool scene, so that takes a lot of the stink off.
I think that's going to wrap it up for this episode.
Yeah.
Yeah, of that Star Trek podcast. It's been an interesting discussion. And I'm hoping there's a lot of points that we've talked about from this episode that I really hope that they pick up and continue in the second half of this season. But for now, I want to thank all my panelists for being here tonight. Rick, I want to get to you first because you look miserable. So tell people where they can find you on the internet so you can go lay down.
You can find me here on that Star Trek podcast. You can find me occasionally on Captain Game Show, Moon Show. Cosmic Potato, the Super Fan Talk podcast, and got a couple things in the works actually that may be coming up soon.
All right, next up, John, where can people find you?
Like Rick, I appear on various shows on the network. The show that I host is Captain Game Show, the trivia wordplay podcast of the Infinite Potato Alliance. Marlon Locke are gonna die.
All right, Tom, have you got anything for the listeners?
No, everything's pretty much been covered. So, like what Rick said.
All right. And finally, Neek, where can people find you?
You can read my Star Trek recaps at superanemic.com. And if you enjoyed Three Body Problem, the show on Netflix, you can listen to a special episode of Moon Show. For All Mankind podcast, also on the Infinite Potato Alliance.
All right. And as for me, you can hear me various places here on the network. But if you're tired of the listening, you can feel free to check out my website at www.planetrisecreative.com. and see the graphic artwork that I do for fun and profit. And that wraps up this episode. Listeners, I want to thank you for listening, for downloading, for hopefully subscribing to the show. Reach out to us on Facebook. Send us an email. Let us know what you think. And feel free to join the Speculation Corner if you have ideas on where this season is going to go. Come back next time. We will be discussing Star Trek Discovery Season 5, Episode 6, Whistle Speak.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of That Star Trek Podcast. You can contact us on Facebook and Twitter, or you can send us an email at thatstartrekpodcast@gmail.com. Help the show grow by giving us a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcatcher. Be sure to join us again next time on That Star Trek Podcast.